Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We continue to ask our listeners, were you involved last week in the Palestine-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's illegal military occupation and colonization of their homeland? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? There are many ways to get involved. Here are a few examples. One, you could join the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights by visiting its website at bcpr.net or by calling 617-491-2313. Two, you could join the Middle East Crisis Coalition by writing to crisismiddleeast@yahoo.com. Three, you could join the Israel-Palestine Task Force of United for Justice with Peace by writing to ujpipaskforce@yahoo.com. Four, if you are Jewish and prefer to join a Jewish group, there is the Boston chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, which you can contact either by calling 617-984-0532 or by visiting its website at jvpboston.org. Five, you could go to Palestine and help with the olive harvest or help Palestinians live their daily lives under occupation by contacting the group Boston to Palestine at its website, bostontopalestine.org. Six, you could work with the International Women's Peace Service in Palestine by applying at iwps-pal.org. And seven, you could go to Palestine under the Birthright Unplugged program, or eight, under the Needle in the Groove program, by applying respectively at birthrightunplugged.org and needleinthegroove.org. It is Sunday, December 9th, 2007. A news item which went unreported in this country was the destruction of an entire village in the West Bank of Palestine on October 29th of this year. 264 residents of the Al-Qasa area, located less than half a kilometer from the Green Line, were forced out of their homes, which were then demolished. The Palestine Solidarity Project, founded in Bethlehem and Hebron, reported that dozens of Israeli soldiers, accompanied by two bulldozers, arrived at approximately 8 a.m. on October 29th, shouted contemptuously at the residents to vacate their homes, and then demolished them. The residents who had previously been evicted under the gun from their homes in the village of Beit Jibrin, which Israel appropriated for itself during the 1948 catastrophe, Nakba, had lived in the Al-Qasa homes for the last 50 years. When Israel completed its illegal wall in the Al-Qasa area, the residents suddenly found themselves on the wrong side of the wall, needing new identity papers and permits appropriate to their new location. Papers and permits which Israel refused to grant. In a highly technical sense, these residents had become illegal aliens in their own homes. We recall in this context Ariel Sharon's interview on April 1st of 2005 with Haaretz, Israel's leading newspaper, during which he said that once the wall is completed, he will move swiftly to expel all illegal aliens. We also recall Ariel Sharon's quote in the late Israeli historian Tanya Reinhardt's book, Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948, in which Sharon describes the current war against the Palestinians as, quote, the second half of 1948, unquote, during which Israel terrorized more than 750,000 Palestinians into leaving their homes at gunpoint and destroyed 500 Palestinian towns and villages. Thus, in Sharon's own words, what we have been witnessing for going on 60 years is not a so-called war on terror, as it is being propagandized, but a war waged by succeeding governments of Israel against the people of Palestine to uproot them from their ancestral homes, expel them, and annex their homes and lands into what Israel calls Greater Israel or Eretz Israel. War, we are told, is one-fourth battlefield and three-fourths public relations and propaganda. the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, which started in earnest after the partition of historical Palestine in November 1947 and continued at a furious pace in the ensuing war of 1948, were propagandized respectively as an existential struggle for survival of the victims of the Holocaust and the War of Liberation. Succeeding wars, including Israel's invasion of Egypt in 1956 with Britain and France, and the 1967 war which Israel started, were also propagandized as defensive wars or existential wars of survival. And after September 11, 2001, Israel began identifying its war with that of the United States by re-propagandizing it as a war on terror. Israel's hugely funded propaganda machine, mouthed by all the mainstream media in this country, has been so successful that when asked about Israel's war, most Americans immediately respond that it is a war on terror, like good little boys and girls who have studied the lessons contained in a manual prepared for them by U.S. media working alongside the Israeli propaganda machine. Yet, despite all the fraudulent propaganda pummeled into us over decades, Israel's war, as seen by its own leaders, is at core a war of expulsion. Most recently, seeking to deflect criticism of its human rights violations and the illegal wall it has built on Palestinian land, Israel has found nothing better than to describe these violations more transparently as efforts to, quote, make life so unbearable that Palestinians will leave voluntarily, unquote. Presumably as the residents of Al-Qasa have left voluntarily. What does making life unbearable mean? Making life unbearable assumes many forms, starting with the erection of more than 500 so-called checkpoints scattered all over the West Bank and Gaza. Of these, less than 3% are actual checkpoints providing entry into Israel proper. The rest are strategically placed points of strangulation between Palestinian towns and villages, and in cities themselves. In the city of El Khalil alone, in the southern West Bank, known in this country as Hebron, the United Nations reported that more than 150 strangulation points have been established in and around the city. All strangulation points, which continue to be propagandized by our media as checkpoints, to evoke the image of obligatory security measures, are actually designed to immobilize the population, destroy the Palestinian economy, which like most other economies depends on the flow of people and goods, and choke off virtually all city life and the normal ebb and flow of traffic. Children going to school, people going to their workplaces, farmers to their fields, families visiting each other, weddings, births, patients going to hospital, and so on. Strangulation points are designed to choke the life out of all Palestinian cities and towns. Other forms of making life unbearable, aside from what have become commonplace abuses and harassments and beatings and arrests of peaceful demonstrators, include preventing ambulances from transporting acutely sick patients or rescuing the wounded, Israeli soldiers deliberately leaving the injured bleed to death, forcing stillborn births by preventing pregnant mothers from seeking help in hospitals, dumping toxic wastes from Israeli factories and settlements on agricultural lands and water systems of Palestinian towns and villages, shooting live ammunition at random into Palestinian homes, killing innocent civilians in their own homes, ransacking Palestinian homes and robbing families of their meager savings, and kidnapping hundreds of young men and women in the dead of night to turn them into collaborators under threat of torture, demolition of family homes, and loss of what little livelihood they may have left. Israel has kidnapped 2,476 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. And that is only a crude introduction to what Palestinians are made to endure every minute of every day of their lives by our country's ally. It doesn't begin to tell the story. The Webster Ninth Collegiate Dictionary defines a concentration camp as, quote, a camp where persons as prisoners of war, political prisoners, or refugees are detained or confined, end of quote. By that definition, every Palestinian city, every town, every village is a concentration camp surrounded on all sides by Israel's occupation army. By far, the biggest concentration camp of all is Gaza. where 1.4 million Palestinians are caged in a gigantic prison whose every entry and exit point is tightly sealed to any Palestinian seeking employment or education or medical help. Transportation into Gaza of agricultural supplies, food, medicine, and consumer products is so restrictive as to be virtually non-existent. In one of its countless obscene military attacks on Gaza's population centers, Israel destroyed a large part of Gaza's only power plant and has refused to allow it to be repaired by Gaza's engineers or by Egypt, which offered to extend its electric transmission line to Gaza and provide relay stations and transformers to distribute electricity to Gaza's cities and towns. The shortages of electricity have led to sewage pond spillovers, as sewage treatment plants are often unable to operate, shortages of potable water as water treatment plants ground to a halt, food spoilages as refrigerators stopped functioning. Hospital operating rooms and emergency treatment centers are at their lowest level of permissible operation. As if that were not enough, Israel recently decided to further reduce fuel and electricity supplies. The Palestinians of Gaza have cried out to the world community to help alleviate their immense suffering, but the world has remained monstrously silent. Less than a year ago, Deputy National Security Advisor Elliot Abrams told a distinguished Palestinian visitor to make no mistake, quote, "Your people will be made to suffer," unquote. What we are seeing in Gaza today is a laboratory for the murder in plain view of an entire population under the auspices of the United States. The pace of that murder being set by what the world community will silently accept. Make no mistake, behind every bullet, every tank shell, every mortar shell, every rocket that kills a Palestinian, there lurks an American finger at the trigger. And so do the fingers of all of us who watch passively and do not speak out or attempt to help. What Martin Luther King said of the civil rights movement in this country rings as true of the Palestinian quest for freedom from bondage as it did of the civil rights movement. History will have to record, Dr. King declared, that the greatest tragedy of this period was not the strident clamor of the bad people, but the appalling silence of the good people. To our listeners who want to extend a helping hand, we refer you to the website of the Gaza Community Mental Health Foundation at www.gazamentalhealth.org. www.gazamentalhealth.org. We are pleased to have two featured guests today. John Roberts is recently retired executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Kathy Roberts is an early childhood educator and organizer for teachers and parents around unhealthy children's media programs. John and Kathy have recently returned from a trip to Bethlehem, which they visited as part of an 18-person delegation from Cambridge. The delegation was inspired by a Cambridge Peace Commission People to People initiative. They join us now from their home in Cambridge. Good morning, John. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine.
Thank you.
First, could you describe the Cambridge Peace Commission's People to People initiative and what it is about?
Well, it's an attempt to for the people of Cambridge to directly reach out to people in Bethlehem, which is in the occupied territories you have described, a town which is now completely surrounded by the wall, so-called security wall. And the People-to-People initiative is in keeping and in tradition with Cambridge, which has at other times reached out to cities facing war and struggle in South America and other places. And so the attempt is to reach directly to for teachers and artists and students to relate on an ongoing basis. This is not just, you know, a one or two trip thing. We're trying to establish relationships in Bethlehem with people who are going about their lives and trying to live you know, a normal life under occupation.
And the other thing I would like to add is that Bethlehem is really important to Christians, Muslims, and Jews, and that in many ways this is very reflective of our very multicultural city of Cambridge. We saw a lot of ties in that. And then also I would like to add that that Bethlehem has put out a call because of what's happening to them. They truly are being strangled, and they have put out a call to the international community. So this was in many ways a response to that.
And you have recently returned from that trip around 8 or 9 days ago, I believe.
Yes.
What can you tell us about your trip? What you found there, the people you met, and how you were received? And please feel free to chip in any time, either one.
Sure.
Well, it was enormously successful from the point of view that we met with exactly the kind of people we wanted to meet with. We met with teachers. We met with students. We met with artists. We met with city councilors. We went into the refugee camps, met with people there, went into their cultural centers and community centers. We met businessmen. We went into the University of Bethlehem. We met students and professors.
We met students. We talked to children. We talked to students.
And healthcare providers. We talked to lawyers, activists, organizers. We talked to women's in their women's cooperatives. And not only talk with them, but our setting up, trying to set up direct relationships so that we can continue the dialogue. Sometimes we do it over a video conferencing. We've already started that, and we will be sending other delegations to Bethlehem of teachers, artists, etc., in order to develop these relationships.
Well, what can you tell us in general about the people of Bethlehem, their way of life and their level of education? Are they any different from us?
Well, this is what was incredible. Are they any different from us? Well, in fact, the teachers that we talk to are very, very much like teachers here. They want their students to do well. They are concerned about the quality of life before students come to school. In terms of artists that we met, they shared with us, you know, their message through their art. In terms of going to, frankly, in terms of talking with the city councilors, it reminded me a little bit. We didn't go to a city council meeting, but we met with some. The chamber was only a little bit different. The people who spoke with us reminded me of some of our city councilors. The same with the Chamber of Commerce. Oh, I have to dare say I've never been to a Chamber of Commerce meeting in Cambridge, but what amazed me was just how similar people were in terms of, for instance, in terms of people's level of education. You know, people have gone to the university. There are lawyers. There are teachers with degrees. There are people who work in the markets, people who are behind the desk at hotels. It reminded me so much of what my life is like in Cambridge on that very people-to-people relationship. That's what was so interesting to me, whether people wore head coverings, hijabs, or not. And, in fact, there were many, many different, in terms of going through the market, speaking with people. You really could not tell unless people offered that, whether they were Christians or Muslims. And I don't believe I don't remember meeting people who were Jewish, because the people who live in around Bethlehem who are Jewish are in settlements, are the colonists. So we did not, you know, but
I think the important thing, the difference between, I mean, there are a lot of similarities, but in order to live your life under occupation, it's very, very difficult to move around at all. We talked to students who would come from Jerusalem every day to Bethlehem to go to the university, had to allow 2 hours. Now, we're talking about going 6 miles. It's about the distance from Harvard Square to Boston Common, allowing 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours at night to go 6 miles, because it takes that long very often to go through the checkpoints.
I would like to add about the checkpoints, the humiliation that students also faced. I mean, one student talked with a tear coming down her cheek about how she went through a checkpoint with her grandmother and the soldier pulled down her grandmother's pants. And it's the time, but it's also the terrible humiliation, sometimes physical assaults that people suffer, that the students suffer.
I think they talk about resistance a lot. They talk about what they refer to as the beautiful resistance, that just going to school every day, just trying to live your life, just trying to get through the checkpoints to get to the markets, for people in the villages to bring their goods in, they see that really as acts of resistance. They understand that the Israelis are trying to make life difficult for them, to suffocate them. They hope they'll go away, but they're not going to go away. And so they see resistance as living their lives, going to school, going to the markets, and standing against the occupation in every possible way they can.
We also met women who from live a day-to-day, their families live a day-to-day existence. They really don't know where their next meal is going to come from. We met women who do embroidery, who started to make soap in their kitchen, and these were sort of beginning home industries. Now, you talk about resistance. What they have done, they have formed cooperatives with other women, and they are creating, markets in order to support their families. That was really, really very inspiring. So if you want to talk about resistance, they feel like that's how they are resisting, is by not falling down and starving to death, but by literally doing something that they can out of their own culture, out of creating things. And when we went to a cooperative, we met with a woman who literally talked about making hundreds of batches of soap that failed time after time again, and finally they came up with a successful batch of soap, and they now in this cooperative are marketing it not only where they are to tourists, but they hope to market it to the outside world. This was really very, very inspiring. Another one that I would like to mention is a family about 6 or 7 years ago lost a child to cancer, living in Bethlehem, and they were very, very thankful for some of the care that the child did receive in I believe in an Israeli hospital, and out of that, what they did, these are people with very meager means. They don't have much money. They started a center called the Meyer Center, the Mayer Center, after their child, for other children with cancer. And what this center does is that children who go for treatments can come there after school, receive support. And what I was inspired by was that it's totally run by volunteers, professional people who have an education or not an education, but they can't get jobs. They can't get jobs. And so what they're doing is they're volunteering and really creating this amazing support center. And again, when we asked, why do you do this? How, under the life that you lead, and they said, this is our resistance. This is the way we are going to continue our culture and our lives.
You have to understand that with a wall completely surrounding the town of Bethlehem, they can't move out. They simply can't drive to Jerusalem. They can't go outside the walls at all. So they have to create ways to communicate and to move. And some of those very creative ways of moving and of getting through checkpoints is also a form of resistance. So they see their life is a life under occupation, but a life in which they are going to resist until there are changes, until finally there'll be a state of Palestine, until finally there'll be some freedom for these people.
This is an amazing account of an indomitable spirit. The Israelis have not succeeded in breaking the spirit, which they have tried to do.
It's interesting because they understand, the Palestinians understand what the Israeli goal is. The Israeli goal is to have them leave. And they understand that. And they're not going to leave.
They can't leave.
They can't leave. Most of them cannot leave.
They don't want to leave.
They are going to stay, and they are going to grow, and they are going to resist, and that's very, very clear.
And they're going to do it nonviolently. They talked about that in every which way. We went into refugee camps where I can tell you I'm a mother of three children, I have grandchildren, and I am known in the community as a mother bear in terms of my children and my grandchildren. And I found it incredible that people could talk about nonviolence when they are being assaulted in so many ways. And that was a very important learning experience for me. I think of myself as being peaceful and nonviolent, but I realized how superficial that was in facing and listening to people in Bethlehem.
And it is the fact that that Israel has not succeeded in breaking their spirit, which motivates them to be ever more brutal.
That's true.
And in fact, what your account seems to will suggest to me is the introduction of microfinance.
Yes.
To microfinance cottage industries.
Yes.
Well, we saw that. We talked to women who had started themselves a financial cooperative with just a few dollars a week, putting it together and accumulating a pool of money that allows them to start their little industries, whether it's soap or whether it's embroidery or whether it's farming or whatever. The women are incredible. They are just gathering strength through these cooperatives and finding the means to keep their families together. Because the men, it's so hard that there's just no work. There's just no work, and so people have to find these creative ways to exist. And we just met some people that have, through their financial cooperatives and through their industries, have found a way to keep their families together and their communities together. It's very inspiring.
And I think the other amazing thing is that how they reach out to other people in the community, they are teaching other people the beautiful art of embroidery. Older women are teaching younger women. That was another very inspiring thing too. When I talked to women who were selling embroidery items.
Alive the traditions and culture.
Yes.
Very, very important.
We can help from here with the microfinance, because we really don't need, in the age of the Internet, we really don't need to have the physical transportation of goods and services. We can have, for example, a desktop publishing, having people prepare annual reports or brochures and then have them sent electronically and get paid when those are done.
Yes.
We can use the paper we have here, because apparently they don't have much in the way of paper, but we can help from here by soliciting business responses to our graphical needs.
Yes.
So that is
what was amazing, and I would like to say that in terms of a message, when we were not asked for, they need money desperately, but what we were asked for, and we were questioned about, why is this happening to us? Why is the media silent?
Yeah. And why are we having to pay the price for the Holocaust? They see that time and time again, they feel like they have paid the price for the Holocaust, that it's their land and their lives which have been disrupted, and they didn't perpetrate this on the Jewish people.
And yet Europe and the United States, which in fact really stayed silent, did not, now it is coming on them. And we heard that in many different ways, in very quiet ways and in some very emotional ways. about the media. So we really, I think that what I came back with, that's very important in the People to People initiative, that if we have any responsibility besides making these contacts in very concrete ways, is also constantly figuring out ways how to bring the voices and the message that we heard, that we have a responsibility to do that.
We have to follow through now on this. Yeah, you know, we have to follow through on developing the contact over there.
Absolutely.
And I think we're all committed to doing that. I think this is a wonderful start, and there's a deep, deep commitment, I think, on those who went, and a deep commitment of many who worked with us who didn't go on this delegation but are part of our work, deep commitment to the Palestinian people, to the people of Bethlehem, and that is rock solid.
I recall the several Christians who left Bethlehem saying that they were contacted by phone, that Israelis contacted them by phone and offered them the green an American passport and the immigration papers if they left Palestine, and they even offered to pay for their trip.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, of course, Bethlehem used to be 75 to 80% Christian. It's maybe 30% now. A lot are leaving. Christians often have more means in order to leave and to find a better life, and some are leaving. And that's sad to see, but most are staying, and I think we are committed to this kind of resistance.
I would also like to share that one day we went to where the wall is, and in the view is a huge settlement called Har Homa, and we're standing there, and what was really, I asked the person who took us, because the wall, this is where it's so striking, the wall is not around the settlement, so it's not a security wall. The wall has actually taken a whole olive grove from an Armenian church. And as I was standing there, I looked down, and suddenly springing up around my feet, well, they weren't in action spring up, but they were these little, tiny, purple, beautiful wild flowers. It was cold. I thought this would not be happening near Fresh Pond where I live, to have little flowers popping out now as the season is changing. And it felt very symbolic to me, because as I looked at that settlement, I also learned that had been a huge forest. The only forest in Bethlehem was flattened out by the Israeli government to make room for a settlement in Bethlehem. And what they're doing now is they're expanding that settlement. So I have to say that while peace talks are going on, and while they have gone on for ages, and there should be no expansion of illegal settlements, that, in fact, the land is being taken to expand.
Now, the Har Homa settlement that you refer to is on top of what was then the Abu Ghneim.
Yes. And people, I have to say, many Palestinians talked about that. That was the theft of, that's where shepherds took their sheep. And that was a very, very destructive assault on the Palestinian culture, as well as their livelihoods.
The December 2007 issue of National Geographic is running an article on Bethlehem, which describes Israelis as fearing Bethlehem's radicalized residents. Did you get any sense of radicalism when you were there?
This is a radicalism. I think that I refer to some of the radicalism, and I think that what I feel like Israel knows very well what it's afraid of. It's afraid of the father whose child died of cancer staying there and building for the community. The radicals are the students who say, we are going to go to school despite what is happening to us. This is our resistance. Though, if that's the most, from a negative point of view, the only radical the only radical things that I saw in terms of people were the military, in terms of humiliating people and stopping people.
There was a very strong movement of tax resistance, and a history of tax resistance in Beth Sahur, which is part of Bethlehem, and it was very, very brutally put down. People felt that the taxes were taken and the money was not going back, into the communities. There was a tax resistance, and Israel moved in, and to quash that, they moved in and they took people's homes, they took their furniture, etc., to quote pay for their taxes. It was very brutally put down. But that resistance, that I think was seen as a radical resistance, and that for that, I think the people of Bethlehem and Beth Sahur, are particularly recognized as standing against and engaging in what might be considered radical activity, but nonviolent, aggressive response to occupation, and that's what's important. It was a nonviolent resistance.
You know what the akin of that would be? The akin of that would be that in the last year and a half, a group of Cambridge residents went to the city council and had a resolution passed about the biolab that is being projected to be built in Boston in the Roxbury section. And because that would affect Cambridge, a group of people met and they went, and that would be, in a lot of circles, considered very radical. And that's the kind of radicalism that we saw. I would call it more activism for the good of the community.
So being a radical is standing up for your rights.
Exactly.
Well, yeah.
That's what I saw.
Being radical is the meaning is going to the roots, and that's what this is. This is going to the roots of resistance in a passive, nonviolent way of dealing with occupation.
What I would also like to say is that what a lot of people in this country don't realize is that Israel takes taxes from people living in the West Bank and in Gaza, and they do not, and they keep those taxes. Now, when you know, our government, we pay taxes, but in return for taxes, we get services. Those services are not, Israel is not doing that. So if you're going to talk about radical, and you're going to talk about oppression, and you're going to talk about violence, it feels to me that that's very violent to do to a people, to starve people, to not pick up garbage, to not have garbage, and to dump waste on people's farmland.
Yeah.
That feels to me actually quite violent.
Yeah, nuclear waste is being deposited not far from Bethlehem. And in those villages around where the waste is developed, of course, the cancer rate now is very high.
It has increased.
And increasing. I mean, it's just a very, very vicious occupation.
And what we should know is that in terms of culturally, for generations, people did organic gardening. Now it's a wonderful thing when you can have an organic garden, whether it's in your little city garden or people pay lots of money to buy organic milk. The Palestinians have been growing, have been producing olive oil organically for
centuries.
Well, for how long? Since ancient times.
Mm.
And now now this is being threatened because of Israel polluting. I mean, this is really quite terrible.
Will you be reporting publicly on what you have seen and experienced, and other members of the delegation?
Yes, on January 16th we'll be doing a report back. It's going to be at the Senior Center
in Cambridge, in Central Square,
right across the street from City Hall. I think the time is 7:00.
We're a little unclear about the time, so maybe Sharif, in coming weeks, you can announce that.
Sure. Sure.
But yes, there will be that report back, and then there will be ongoing work in terms of continuing the video conferencing, students to students, which we've already started, and we will begin to put together the next delegation to continue the work.
Is there going to be another delegation sometime in the spring?
Yes, we're not sure what the timing is, but we already have had interest on the part of other people, and we hope to start building and working on that right away. And I also want to say is that it's hard in a short amount of time to go into details, to go into really depth. And if people would like to talk more or to have more information, to start things in their own community, in any, other communities, that we feel very open to talking to people and to meeting with people about that.
Is there a website that people can get to?
Well, we have a website. We have a kind of prototype website. We really don't have a domain name yet, but very shortly, I think we will have a website. As I say, we already have.
It was started by somebody with their personal name, so we need to sort of.
So
move
we
on
need
that.
It, yeah. But that is only a couple weeks away, we think.
And there is an email address, CambridgeBethlehem@gmail.com.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes.
Are any of our listeners who are interested in learning more about that initiative? The Peace Commission's People-to-People Initiative with Bethlehem, please write to CambridgeBethlehem@gmail.com. Thank you so much, John and Kathy,
Thank
for
you,
being
Sheree.
Our guests
Thank
today
you.
And for sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye. You've been listening to retired director of the ACLU of Massachusetts, John Roberts, and Cambridge early childhood educator, Kathy Roberts. And that is all we have for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sheree Pham signing off for now and reminding our listeners to get involved now in the good fight for peace with justice in Palestine and Israel. Thank you.